Hello and welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns. Many years ago, when I was a small boy, this is a long time ago. Back in those days, we only had black and white radio. But I used to go fishing with my dad, and that was a big influence on me, as anybody who's read my books will know. But one of the things that was a very common sight around the banks and the little ponds in Merseyside where we used to go fishing were water voles. And these little sort of bright-eyed creatures who pretty much got used to having anglers around, really. And they'd swim about around the banks and scurry around. And every now and again, a little bright-eyed, intelligent-looking creature would pop its head out of the weeds and have a good look at you. And these were water voles. Unfortunately, there aren't not many water voles about these days. And so on today's show, I'm going to bring on in a moment a lady who is, I would have to say, I think, a champion for the old water vole. She's a writer, a painter, and a photographer, and she lives in the Derbyshire Dales. And she's written a book called The Water Vole, and her name is Christine Gregory. Hello, Christine, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, John. Yeah, I'm fine. I'll just complete the full title of the book, which is The Water Vole, One of Britain's Most Endangered Mammals.
Right, well, they certainly are. For folk who don't know what a water, some people will never have seen, sadly will never have seen a water vole. Tell me a little bit about it. What does it look like?
Well, they are one of Britain's sort of largest rodents, around the same size, roughly speaking, to look at as a brown rat, which of course are kind of major hate figures in lots of people's
point of view. Yeah.
But they're actually much smaller, much lighter, but they're voles. So they've got this rather sweet little rounded face. So everything that you know, might characterize a rat, it's kind of big, round ears and it's very sharp pointed face. Is opposite, you know, it's a sort of sharp face, whereas water voles are rounded and sweet, and they're completely associated with watercourses, ponds, lakes, reed beds. You know, they depend very much on watercourses, and they live within a few yards of a watercourse. Yeah.
So they're a sort of cuddly water rat. Is that fair?
Well, one of the problems with dear old Kenneth Graham and Wind in the Willows of calling it the water rat has led to a lot of confusion in people's minds. So actually they have been persecuted for numerous reasons. They're kind of under attack from all sides, really.
Uh-huh.
Chiefly habitat loss, but they're, you know, very superficial, quick glance. Oh, it's a rat. Mm-hmm, shoot mm-hmm. it. So I've talked to boys who've taken pot shots at them. I've talked to river keepers who've been told to, you know, kill them, actually because they're water voles. But they have been, you know, really come under a lot of attack because of their slightly sort of superficial you know, similarity to the brown rat, which of course is not a native species, whereas the water vole is one of our most ancient mammals. I mean, their history on this bit of land that we call Britain now, but through its all its shifting periods as tectonic plates have shifted, going back right into sort of ancient history, pre-glacials, in other periods, 2.5 million years, there is evidence of their ancestry all the way back. They've survived ice ages. They were here when this was, you know, a tropical landscape where you know, we had hippos swimming along the River Derwent in the middle of Derbyshire. You know what I mean?
Is that right?
They go back all the way, and they have survived. But in this century, and particularly in the last few decades of the 20th century, their decline has been absolutely shocking.
And why is that? Because what you're saying is right. I mean, if you go to those ponds that I used to fish in today, you certainly won't see any water voles, whereas they used to be common. So I just wonder why is that? What's the decline been caused by?
Well, there are lots of reasons. And in my book, I've sort of explored this very carefully. And the history of their decline is a very long one and a very incredibly interesting one as well. I mean, if you go all the way back, the Romans had a major impact on the water vole. So I've got a little section in my book called The Decline and Fall of the Roman Water Vole.
All right.
It's actually, you know, all the stuff that the Romans brought to Britain in terms of animals, in terms of the way that they farmed, the way that they altered marginal areas, crucially their draining of areas of marsh and all the rest of
right
it.
Right.
And you know, the gradual sort of breakup of different kind of untouched landscapes meant that the water vole population that was here through the Iron Age was, you know, really, really hammered. So there is this big drop off, and we know this through remains found in archaeological sites, where at certain levels you can see what the abundance of different mammals looked like. So going all the way back, but that story runs right through. So if you think of the incredible changes to landscapes, urbanization, road building, massive changes to our watercourses, the canalization of things, our needs as cities have grown to build reservoirs, to drain areas. Uh-huh. We have altered all our watercourses tremendously, enormously. Yeah. But also we have polluted the world considerably. Yeah. But interestingly enough, pollution isn't one of the worst aspects of their, endangerment. It's really habitat loss. Now, right. What water voles need as a sort of bottom of the food chain prey animal, they need to have a lot of vegetation, wide margins of riparian, what we call riparian vegetation. That stuff that things that come up that grow in the water, water weeds.
Yeah, yeah.
And the wide margins that you see along streams and lakes have been, you know, really eroded away by a lot of farming areas, the Peak District particularly. We have massive amounts of grazing going on. It's a livestock farming area. So you'll get sheep, cattle right up to the stream side, and they erode away and destroy sort of riparian margins.
Right.
But in urban areas, we've just made lots of watercourses impossible for these little animals to cope with, because in order for this species to survive, it needs its populations need to link up, and they link up upon the sort of linear waterways. That's right. How they do. So we've got all those issues, habitat loss, and massive over engineering of all of our watercourses. I could come in on the other problems, but the real nail in the coffin of the water vole is the mink, the American mink.
Right.
So,
okay.
So the story there is, I don't do short answers. I'm really sorry about this, but you might want to kind of keep.
All right. Maybe there isn't a short answer. Just get it. So what's the problem with the mink?
Shall I just quickly say, what about American mink? Okay. So this kind of goes back in a way to Hollywood, which is an interesting thing. So post-war period, the glamorization of, you know, the mink coat and all the rest of it, all those old black and white films, it was possible suddenly for this, the thing that represented richness and, you know, glamour and all that, mink farming became a way for that to be more affordable for the middle classes. So, and also the army has an interesting role in this, that it was actually presented to retired army officers as you're thinking of a business, you're 55, you've come out of the war, or you're 45, you come out of the war. Why don't you invest your army pension in running a mink farm? You're kind of someone who's not frightened of shooting stuff, so you're killing things. Why not develop mink farms? So we suddenly have this explosion of mink farms all over.
Right,
sort of
right, okay.
All over the country, countryside areas. And these were not secure. So what happened was, all over Wales, England, Scotland, we'd got mink farms. Mink were escaping. And the first ones to breed in the wild, 1957, I think it was, found to breed in the wild on the River Tyne down in Devon. Within 2 decades, they were across every single catchment in Britain, across the country. So they started trapping them. Ministry, MAF, we used to call it, Ministry of Agriculture, Food and Fisheries, would be trapping, set about trapping it. And they were overwhelmed by the task. They were everywhere. They were absolutely everywhere. And I can just say, when I first went to live in the northwest of Scotland in 1972, there were mink up there on the beaches. And I thought, bloody hell. So it's an otter. I didn't mean to swear, but anyway, it's an otter. No, it's not. It's a mink. And I've still seen them up there. I've seen one at Sana, which, you know, the sort of far point of the Arden American point, the westernmost point in the British Isles.
Oh, right, right. Yeah, I know where that is.
On a little tidal island right out there. They've gone absolutely everywhere.
Right.
Now,
right.
Why did they get everywhere? They got everywhere because they were unchallenged along these rivers, streams, lakes, because guess who was missing? The otter. Yeah. Head of the food chain, top predator. The otters were not there. So uncontested, why were they not there? They were poisoned by agricultural and industrial chemicals, but crucially, organochlorine, seed dressings and sheep dips, which were killing our streams and rivers.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
Killing, yeah. You know, it was travelling up. It bioaccumulates in the flesh of otters so that it was basically making it impossible for them to breathe. They just couldn't function. They couldn't flourish, and we had otters extinct through most of the counties of England. A few hung on in the West Country,
right,
in Wales, and there were plenty up in Scotland, but they were also impacted. So what we had, I've got a chapter in my book, the water vole, the mink and the otter,
right,
the interrelation between the collapse of this wonderful little mammal, water vole, that's been with us throughout our lives, really, and has a very sort of fond place, partly through Wind in the Willows. but also, you know, they're one of the very few British mammals that you can watch. You know, they don't have this fear response to humans, unless by sound, but they don't have the scent response. And of course, they're diurnal. They're around during the day. So it's a devastating blow to, you know, any wildlife watchers of any age, that we can't see the lovely creature. But of course, it's what it tells us about what we've done. So I'm always a big picture, small picture person. So in writing about this mammal, I was drawing attention 4 years ago to what everyone is now talking about, the sixth extinction, the last of which, of course, took out the dinosaurs. So this is part of my mission.
Right.
It's been a very, very long time to look at. First of all, I did the brown hare, looked at the brown hare, which tells a lot about the health or the lack of health of our farming landscapes.
Right.
And then later on, you know, the water vole that tells us not only about the state of our rivers and streams, but tells us basically about how human impacts are wiping out.
Well, one of the things that's happening in Scotland right now, is, and indeed, I think, down in Cheshire, is the reintroduction of the beaver. And I was, from what you're saying, the beaver should be a pretty good ally to the water vole. Is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the beaver, and it's interesting because Derek Gow, who I did speak to, and he's all over the place. I don't mean all over the place in a bad way. I mean, he's running around all over the place.
I interviewed him about a month ago. He's been on the show.
Sure. Well, you know what his project has been. And
yes.
You know, he breeds, he captive breeds and releases water voles, beavers. He's probably going to move on to lynx next. I'm not sure he might even be there now. But he's,
he didn't admit to that.
He didn't admit to it. No, okay. That's a tricky one. Anyway, he's, but, you know, by doing that, we know what beavers function in generating sort of healthy ecosystems.
Yes.
Water ecosystems is fantastic. They are our natural flood defences. So
That's right.
I think, you know, there's a perfect story in here, as there is about so much of our wildlife conservation, that in conserving habitats for wildlife, we're actually saving ourselves. So my story, I used to do lots of slideshows before you couldn't go and
before you
could,
yeah.
was about how, you know, in protecting the species, giving the habitats that these species, you know, that the water vole needs, we're actually saving ourselves, because all measures to slow the flow off our mountains, rivers, uplands, the beaver has a role to play there. Very exciting what can happen there. But also the protection of coastal marshes These are all things that will increase the health and the slowing. People have understood now that the heavy engineering approach to channeling water gives us urban flooding, gives us major flooding of huge areas through, you know, industry, through housing, again, that should never have been built on the floodplain. Mm-hmm. But we know that heavy engineering doesn't work, but actually the gentle, subtle work with nature all the way down from the uplands with all our sources of water are the way that we can really, really help ourselves. So we've got all those things. We've got management of uplands for storing carbon, which of course is the great issue that we have faced, let's face it, for 30, 40 years, but now we're at the critical tipping point, as we know. But water supplies, you know, this is more and more of an issue.
Yeah.
Flood control, extreme weather, all of those things, that sort of group of solutions are good for humans and human societies right down in the cities, but they're fantastic for all our wild creatures, because one of the things that's very interesting that people didn't realise until about 30 years ago is that water voles that you think of, nice little flowing, slow flowing stream, water voles, yeah, that's where they live. But actually people have found that they live really high up in the mountains of Scotland.
That's right. I've heard, I don't know, I don't know if you're familiar with the Monolea Mountains here, but there's an area there, Coigna Fern, where I believe where they don't shoot grouse anymore. And obviously the mountain hare are protected now. So I believe there's a small colony there. I've not seen them, but I believe they are there. So well, what do you think overall is the... Where's the waterfall going? What's the future, do you think, for the waterfall?
Well, I think, you know, people are, this lockdown, I mean, it is kind of weird because I'm guessing like you, but also like me, I can't remember a single moment in my life where wildlife didn't mean everything to me and landscapes and the outdoors.
It's
the major, the major thing that carries me through my life and keeps me sane. And I've had a lot of difficulties to deal with. You know, we all have, but you know, that is my place and it's all of our places. So I sort of feel that where we're at now with the lockdown and the awakening to this amongst so many people in this country and in various parts of the world, you know, hearing properly birdsong, noticing the real deep connection that we need to get back to. I think that that can drive us in the right direction. But of course, we need a government that has a grasp of that. And that's where we're at, isn't it? I mean, it's devastating, I think. I'm quite a political person, you know, and so I've never understood why, you know, the thrust of politics, even from the direction that I come from as a socialist, has never really strongly until now seen how we join all these things up. And so that saddens me a great deal. It's still, you know, that stuff is like the soft politics. I'm sorry, it really isn't. It's the hard politics of how we survive on this planet.
I think, you know, I sort of come, because I live in Scotland, I see things from a Scottish perspective. And I certainly think that, you know, the crux of all our... political issues or social issues is actually land management, how we use the land that we've got. Does that strike a chord with you?
100% agree with you. It's everything. It is everything. And it comes down to ownership, our sense of who we are. And I think, you know, I admire Nicola Sturgeon tremendously. I love the Highlands. Ever since I first went there, you know, when I was 15 years old and we had most of our holidays in the Highlands.
Right.
Monstrous that so much of it belongs to so few. I mean, what has gone so skewed and so wicked and so wrong up there? But, you know, the destruction for shooting, it's kind of unbelievable.
It is.
You know, we still get governments defending the burning of heather. And actually, you know, is there protection of the mountain hare in Scotland? Because there isn't here. They knock them out. We've got a little...
Yes, it came in fairly recently. The mountain hare is now a protected species. And so I think you can still obtain licenses to shoot it, but I think it's the beginning of, talking about politics, I think it is the beginning of quite a significant change that's happening in the Highlands. For years we have, as you say, these great monoliths of Highland estates and landowners who've owned the land and controlled it, and have blocked pretty well every attempt by the Scottish government to legislate to control what they do on that land, but that's actually beginning to change. I really think that the obviously the protection of the mountain hare is good news for mountain hare, but it's more importantly than that, I think it does symbolise the beginning of a change, the beginning of a shift away from that dominance by the big landowners. So yeah, I think things are changing in Scotland. I think England's getting left behind, really.
Well, I mean, you know, look at what we've got as a government. I do think that that wildlife is front and centre of young people's, you know, I get very agitated when I see, we're going straying wildly off water voles here, but
well, not really, because actually, you know, the reason the water voles have declined is, as you quite rightly said, because of a much wider picture about what's happened in the environment. You can't, as you know, everything in the environment is connected to everything else, as are we. So actually, you're right, I think, to talk about these issues.
Well, I think it's absolutely at the heart of it. I mean, you know, plastics pollution in our rivers now is what everyone's talking about, you know. And the thing about the water vole is that it's so low, you know, it's kind of a modest little animal that if you took the pressure off water voles in terms of habitat, they would flourish. But they need something like a 50% survival rate over winter. And currently the best that they can get is a 30% survival rate over winter. So that means, you know, you've got a small population of water voles, and there's only like 12 of them, then you've got three, and then there's a huge gap along the riverbank. There's about 3 miles. They are known in the spring, which is the time when they disperse away from the site where they spent the winter. Mm-hmm. If the gaps between these populations are too great, that's an extinction. So what we've been watching since the 1980s is like populations, all these little populations that might have been within dispersal distance are so fragmented that they decline and then they die out.
Yeah, there's a term for that, is there not? Is it called extinction debt? I could be wrong. When you're actually seeing, although you're seeing, say, water voles and you're seeing certain animals, actually their population has declined below a sustainable level. So what you're seeing is, although they might appear to be in the landscape, they're actually declining. Is that a thing?
Well, I've I'm not a scientist, but I've read a terrific amount, a number of papers. And I've had to get to grips with all sorts of things that, you know, were well beyond me. But, you know,
it's a learning curve, isn't it?
Learning curve. So it's kind of looking at, everything from, you know, how great a level of disturbance, what the impact that will be on a population, through to, deep biology, DNA studies and all the rest of it, of what's going on with different populations, and also evolutionary behavioural changes that have happened very, very fast. So here in Derbyshire, because I think it's important that you start with a real understanding of what's going on. So I've spent my 2 years building up to doing this book, out doing surveys, still do surveys, but just watching and looking at different watercourses, and then actually looking at the problems in my own, for myself, to see what issues are. So here in Derbyshire, the Peak District, it's not like the Highlands. We've got a landlocked county, so our rivers, our lakes, our streams are absolute hotspots for visitors, and particularly during lockdown. You see, the glories of people connecting with nature also meant that we've got people thronging to sensitive habitats and having impact on wildlife. Now, water voles have to almost consume their body weight by, you know, there's a lot of chewing and chomping goes on. They have to do that, and they have to be relaxed enough to be able to do that. So
right.
If you get 30 dog walkers all letting yes. their dogs go in the water, or just even walking past and being a bit loud and shrieky, mm-hmm. you've mm-hmm. cut down the opportunity for that mammal to do what it needs to do. So there's a very sad element to all this, that in a way yeah. the kind of landscapes and territory where wild creatures do better are things like, you know, military firing ranges, or
yes, that's right, yes,
actually private estates, you know, actually places where people don't go because yeah. they can yeah. live their lives undisturbed. But the funny thing about water voles is that they can tolerate close proximity to humans, not dogs, that's for sure.
Right.
There's a real problem, and I've tackled people without in the nicest possible way, but it's an awkward situation, you know. Yeah. Sorry, there are waterfalls here. They are actually protected species. Yes, please, you know, could you put your dog on the lead? No, don't eat it. Oh, he'd never catch one. No, it doesn't really matter. They're disturbing them. You know, it's difficult, tricky stuff, this. Anyway, but wild animals can do very, very well, and we won't get to see them. And there's a sort of tragedy about that, really.
Yeah, I think it's one of the big sort of contradictions that we've got in that, you know, we want people to get out into the countryside. We want people to appreciate wild things. But at the same time, the population that we have is destroying the very thing that we want to value. I mean, I think, you know, I think it's very important that people do get out into the country, and in some ways lockdown has sort of focused us on that, because, you know, no one is going to vote for policies or talk to politicians about things unless they value the countryside themselves.
I agree with you. Yeah, you can't care about a thing if you've never seen it.
Yeah.
But, you know, just sort of back on the water bowl thing, really, is but like any prey species, what they really, really need is cover.
Right.
So, you know, I did a book about a little river. I lived in this little village in an old lead miner's cottage in Yulegrave. The village is called Yulegrave. And we had our river running through. It's a tiny little river, very good populations of water voles. When we first moved there 30 years ago, over 30 years ago.
Right.
And by the time we'd been there for 5 or 10 years, they were extinct. They were gone. You couldn't ever see them.
Right.
So I wrote a book about this river that was about all aspects of it, social history and cultural history and natural history.
Right.
And we made money. This was a local group that commissioned me to do this. We got a
okay,
grant.
Okay.
But quickly, we spent money on fencing off the river. Because I said, first thing we should do for nature conservation, for water voles, is fence off the river. Half
right.
a mile.
Right.
Fence off. Within a matter of months, all this wonderful vegetation came back. This is a little limestone stream. The water voles came back the following year, having not seen one for something like 3 or 4 years. I went out one evening. I saw 5 water voles.
Wow.
So the recovery of habitat is like instantaneous. And where you've got historic sites where water voles have wanted to be, they will always come back.
Right.
And it's interesting.
Right.
I was walking along the Derwent just like the day before yesterday to the only spot close to where I live where I'd ever seen water voles. And I could see that those little tunnels through the vegetation.
Oh, yeah.
Were still there. So they'll hang on. But it's how we kind of improve this whole strips of landscapes, because what we've done is we've made more and more sections of our rivers and streams inhospitable to water voles and everything else that goes along with it.
Okay, that's fascinating. So it's really about habitat restoration. We've only got a few minutes left, so I was thinking, if folk want to go and maybe would like to see a water vole or see an animal, and they're wondering if it's a rat or it's a water vole, how do you tell the difference between a rat and a water vole? Because obviously one of the problems for poor old water voles is they get mistaken for rats.
Yeah, well, I just want to say one very quick thing about mink and why they were so...
Oh, right, go ahead.
The nail in the coffin. They're a niche predator, okay? A female mink is unafraid of diving into the water and will go into the underwater. I didn't talk enough about how water voles live. They live in little burrows
yes.
in river at different levels. They have entrances underwater, midway, and on the top of the bank.
Right.
And that's the only mammal that will, you know, stoats and weasels will predate, foxes will, owls will, herons will, perch, pike will. But the mink will go down and can enter the tunnel and just clean out all the babies as she feeds her kits.
That's the predator.
And then the juveniles that will be around now will also be able to do that thing of predating right into the burrow. So all the defences that they've built up over thousands and thousands of years for the native predators are useless in relation to the mink. So that's why the mink is the nail in the coffin of an already endangered mammal. Now moving on, you're going to say, where might you see them and how would you know the difference? They are, I have to say, they're just so cute. So they've got this flattened nose, and it's almost like a sort of virtuous thing. I've got a picture of, if you've seen the water vole, but there's a picture of a rat, there's a picture of a water vole. The water vole is this sort of beautiful chestnut, shiny little one with its little beady eyes and furry ears. It's got little tiny ears that almost you can't see, but its ears are really close to its head. Rats, you're not going to mistake a rat's ears. They're like kind of Minnie Mouse ears sticking right up.
Okay.
On them. Water voles have got tails. So people used to think it's a vole. They don't have tails, do they? You see bank voles, they've barely got a tail. But water voles have got a tail, but it's got fur along it. So lots of people have thought, no, it was a rat, it had a tail. And they say, no. Water voles do have tails, about two-thirds the length of their body.
Yeah, but a rat tail doesn't have fur, does it?
Rat tail is that rather disgusting looking thing that's got scaly. It's all scaly, isn't it? With like
your
tufty bits on it. Not that I've got anything against rats.
Nothing against rats at all. Well, thanks very much for that. That really clarified that. For anyone who wants to know more, what I'll do is I'll put a link to Christine's books on the page for this podcast. And if you'd like to find out more, then you can get hold of a copy of The Water Vole, The Story of Britain's Most Endangered Mammals, written by Christine, which is a fascinating book. And I really love hope that in the future we'll see more water voles about. Okay, thanks very much then, Christine.
Yes, thanks a lot then, John.
Okay. Pleasure having you. Nice to speak to you.
Nice to speak to you. Bye-bye then.
Bye-bye.